It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we meet a man held hostage by 1,200 goats. Coach handbag creator Miles Kahn lives the dream. Leave the pressure cooker city job for the idyllic country life. Maybe make some goat cheese on the weekends. Well, be careful what you wish for. Well, the Stearns are into the paragon of pancakes at Dot's Diner in Wilmington, Vermont. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson answers that pressing question, will your next bottle of Chateau Lafite have a screw top? Then it's the latest in high-tech, high-global dining in a restaurant that is, you will never guess where. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's one of those be careful what you wish for stories. We hear from a man held hostage by 1,200 goats. Miles Kahn created Coach handbags and Coach goat cheese. His book is The Perils and Pleasures of Domesticating Goat Cheese. Well, wine maverick Joshua Wesson answers that pressing question, is the wine cork gone forever? Boston Globe food editor Cheryl Julian talks the real world of modern cooking. Then it's a new take on high-tech, high-global dining in a restaurant that is, you will never guess where. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, one thing you may not know about us is that in addition to Michael's obsession with hot dogs and, a few other Michael specialties like chocolate turtles, he is an absolute maniac for pancakes.
Well, I should say parenthetically that as a lad of 13, I actually won a pancake eating contest. And from that day on, I felt that pancakes were my particular bailiwick.
Well, this makes a lot of sense, Michael.
Yes.
And so, leaning into this, we found probably the best pancakes in North America recently at a place called Dots in Wilmington, Vermont. Now, basically, any pancakes in Vermont are terrific because you get real maple syrup. You don't get, that corn syrup in a bottle that shall remain nameless.
Excuse me, but as a Midwesterner, I have nothing against corn syrup. I do like maple syrup, but let us not denigrate corn syrup. Go on, Jane.
But the pancake at Dots, will you describe it, Michael, since you're the big pancake fan?
Okay, there are all kinds of pancakes at Dots, plain, with blueberries, with apples, with bananas in the batter. And needless to say, this is a made-from-scratch batter. And the pancakes are fluffy, light, thick, but not overly thick. But there is one kind of pancake that is really kind of spectacular, and that is the one called the Berry Berry pancake. And in the pancake batter of the Berry Berry pancakes are blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, and pieces of strawberry.
And fresh ones.
And that's the thing. I mean, these are not kind of frozen processed fruits where you taste a certain vague sweetness. You really taste each individual berry in the batter. And it's in the batter, and you see it sort of on the surface of the pancake. You see like a little red, a little black, a little purple. And then when you cut into it with the edge of your fork, I mean, you see these brilliant berries with a little bit of that real maple syrup that Jane was talking about. It really is an extraordinary pancake eating experience.
Is this year-round that they do this?
This is year-round. Dots is open for 3 meals a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
And when berries are not in season, they have picked their own berries and they do freeze them, but they still taste nothing like the commercial frozen ones. I mean, I can't stand it when I get a blueberry pancake and it might as well have like blue M&Ms in it or something, or just blue dots, where you have absolutely no taste of blueberries. But this is just the most sumptuous pancake, and Dots is just a little tiny town cafe. I mean, there's nothing fancy about it at all.
What else do they do?
Well, as I said, 3 meals a day. And at lunch, it's a great place for a real old-fashioned blue plate special, meaning, hot turkey, roast beef, meatloaf, pork roast, sided with real mashed potatoes and homemade gravy. Mm-hmm. Really great soups that are made there, especially good in the winter. The bread is homemade. The waitresses are professional waitresses. They really do their job well. It's just one of those nice, old-fashioned, reliable places you don't see that many of anymore, where you feel absolutely well taken care of from the moment you walk in.
And they only have one strange thing on the menu that we didn't order. just because it's so weird. It's broccoli cordon bleu, which I've sounded very strange, although I'm sure at Dots it's probably, you know, broccoli with butter on it.
I now know something that scared off the Stearns, a stalk of broccoli with a French
broccoli.
Name.
No, it wasn't the word broccoli. It was cordon bleu attached to it.
You're scaredy cats. Hey, guys, thanks.
We are. Bye, Lynn.
Goodbye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. Any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, you know that broccoli that Jane was talking about? Well, it probably was ham and cheese, because whenever you see cordon bleu in a title, it means, essentially, ham and cheese. Now, today, titles like these are tossed around without a lot of thought, but in the past, they were part of this code that every classically trained French chef knew. In fact, each chef carried around this little book. It was called the Repertoire de Cuisine. It was like a secret decoder. It was filled with formulas for dishes. If you, the diner, knew the code, reading a French menu was a snap. Let me give you an instance. Veronique in a title meant glazed grapes on the plate. Now, usually that was with poached sole. Bonne femme means white wine, diced bacon, and little onions. My favorite is what I think of as the missing link between real food and tater tots. Dauphine potatoes. Now, listen to the formula from Repertoire. Mashed potatoes mixed with egg yolks and cream puff batter. They're shaped into little corks and they're deep fried. Now, come on, isn't that a tater tot? Joshua Wesson is my favorite maverick. He's a wine expert who follows his own drummer. He believes good wine can be had for little money, and he's always coming up with new ideas for us to try. Josh, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy being had.
Well, I got a question for you. Screw-top wines, what's your take on this? What is happening with this? Because we heard it was starting, but I'd like to know what you think about it.
Well, I think that the wineries are finally putting the screws on this 300-year-old habit of stoppering their products with tree bark. When you think about it in the abstract, using a piece of bark, which is really what cork is, mm-hmm. to stopper a bottle of wine is medieval. And it's caused a lot of problems in the wine industry because it's very hard to control the quality of the cork, this piece of tree bark, because it's a natural product. And in the process of harvesting it and cleaning it and refining it and shaping it, it can sometimes pick up odd flavors. And when you stick one of those odd-flavored corks in a bottle, it transfers the taste to the wine. And thus, there's a term called corked wine, which has afflicted the wine industry since there was a wine industry, but it's gotten really bad now because there's a lot more wine being made and the cork trees just can't keep up. So if you were making a consumer product and one bottle in 100 was bad, you'd probably want to figure out a way to make it better. And that's what's driving screw tops to go on top of wine bottles.
Well, but screw top has always been associated with cheap and not very good to drink. So what's evolved now? Because, I mean, selling a screw top wine, I would imagine, is still tough.
It is tough, and of course, you know, if a sommelier presents it to you, you certainly don't want to smell it, because there's nothing that you could cut your nose on the metal.
Yeah.
But there's been a technological breakthrough in the last few years, led by a company called Stelvin, which has created a high-end screw top, not the stuff that you used to see on Ripple and Boone's Farm and cheap wines of our past,
mm-hmm.
but this is stuff that, that can be used to seal a very high-quality bottle of wine. And in New Zealand, there are a collection of very forward-thinking producers who all make great wine, and they banded together and they said, we're going to put our very best wine under screw tops and see if people will buy them. And in fact, the industry has reacted in an almost unanimously positive way. You're seeing screw tops come out on $90 bottles of wine and $50 bottles of wine and $19 bottles of wine, and not just in the league-leading areas of New Zealand and Australia, but all over the wine world.
$90 a bottle. Well, give me some examples.
Well, I just tasted a Felton Road Pinot Noir. It's an artisanal producer in New Zealand, and they bottled their very best red wine, this Pinot Noir, with a screw top on it, and they sell it for $90 a bottle. And people are buying it. In fact, you can't find it. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It came out, and it just evaporated. And, of course, the great thing about a screw top is you can screw it back on. So if you enjoy a little bit of the wine and you don't finish the bottle, you've got a perfect seal. Stick it back in the fridge, and it will last a lot longer. So it makes sense from a use point of view. It just doesn't make sense from the old traditional, I want to touch the cork point of view.
Right, right. So some more ideas.
Well, I had last night a lovely little Riesling from Australia, from Jacobs Creek, and that wine's a lot less than $90. It's $14. And I also had a Bonnie Doon red. Their entry-level red. Bonnie Doon's very famous for making all sorts of Rhone-ish wines. And they have a Rhone-style blend called Big House Red. I keep on seeing the escape as people come down on the front of this bottle from this prison. And the wine is, you know, it's a nice illusion because the wine literally just escapes from the bottle when you unscrew it. It's one of those easy drinking reds that you just put into a mug and knock back with abandon. They also make a white version of it, and both of them have screw tops. It's $12.
That's pretty reasonable.
But the people who are late to the party here are the French. They're always the most traditional when it comes to embracing innovation in the wine world, certainly when it comes to changing things that are considered part of the wine experience or ritual. But there are a couple of very forward-thinking producers, mostly in southern France, in the Rhone and the Languedoc. And I tasted a Gascon white from Colombelle for $8 with a screw top that absolutely just was delicious, lip-smacking and yummy, and I recommend it to all.
Well, okay, so the message is do not turn away from the screw top.
Fear not the screw top. It will help you help yourself.
Hear, hear. Hey, thanks a lot, Josh.
Pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is creator and co-owner of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can get the names of his screw top wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's brought to you by the Farmers of Organic Valley. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every single week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique, and shopping tips, and it's free. So sign up on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Miles Kahn, a man willingly held hostage by 1,200 goats, big-time global dining, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. You You know, some of us are slower than others. It took me quite a while to connect the name of a popular brand of goat cheese with the name of a popular line of handbags. Now, the name is Coach, and there's a story here, and maybe a life lesson. Think about this. How many of us dream of giving up workaday life, buying a farm, and becoming maybe a bread maker or a cheese maker? It seems so idyllic. Well, the man behind Coach Goat Cheese did just that. He is Miles Kahn. Now, he's done a book about it. The book is The Perils and Pleasures of Domesticating Goat Cheese, Portrait of a Hudson Valley Dairy Goat Farm. Miles Kahn, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Look, Miles, I love your bags, I love your cheese, but how did you go from classy handbags to goat cheese? It's quite a long trip there.
Yeah, it's an improbable story, and that's what we set out to write in this book. But the truth of it is that we were just looking for a place to go away on our three-day weekends. You know, after many years of struggling in the bag business, we'd finally come up with a hit, you know, the Coach bag. And we were successful. We had gone, as I'd like to say, from bags to riches. Mm-hmm. And we were enjoying all the perks of a successful business, which included having a three-day weekend. And I thought it would be a great idea if we could have maybe a farm not too far away that we could spend the three-day weekend and to kind of distract us from what we were doing the rest of the week. My notion of a farm was the picture that I got from reading books to our kids when they were little. You know, the Farmer Brown waving his hand, the cow and the pig talking to each other. So we began looking for what I thought would be a working farm. And, of course, if it was working, it wasn't for sale. And if it was for sale, it wasn't working. And so we ended up with a big non-working farm, about 300 acres, 2 hours outside of the city. And then we began to scratch our heads. What can we do with it? We felt very responsible now for this beautiful piece of land. And we ultimately came up with this idea, which at the time seemed like a terrific idea, that we would grow hay and that we would feed the hay to goats and that we would milk the goats and make cheese out of milk. So we had come up with this whole new way of marketing hay.
But wait a minute. When was this? How long ago?
We're talking 20 years ago, and that's important to realize because with all this idea seemed so terrific, the fact was that at that time there was really no market for goat cheese in this country. So we were just counting on the fact that if we provided it, there would be a market. So it was naivete is the key word. So we consulted with as many people as we could find, and we went through disastrous mistakes and miscalculations, and it's a wonder that it all came out right as it did.
Well, you said you wanted to make hay into milk.
It's value added, really. We added value to the hay. So this is what keeps the farm going. We have about 700 acres now in cultivation. And we're growing our own hay. We're growing our own grains and the straw and the bedding. And we're just 2 hours outside of the city. And we're delivering fresh goat cheeses that a week ago were milk. And by the way, that is what distinguishes our Coach Farm cheeses from most of what you find in the market. They're not vacuum packed. We send them down fresh, and the stores buy and the restaurants buy once a week.
But you started out for a three-day weekend. You wanted a place to get away. I mean, you had never looked a goat in the eye, right?
not in the eye or anywhere else. Everyone seems to think that this was a retirement business, and far from that, this was a business that suddenly took up all our energies, and we finally had to, we couldn't do the both. We were going back and forth from the farm to the city, and finally we couldn't tell which was back and which was forth. Mm-hmm. And that was the time that we decided that it was time to sell the business, and we sold the leather goods business to Sara Lee. And they have thrived ever since. And we struggled on, and we went through a period there that was so desperate that we would have welcomed an unfriendly takeover. They didn't. And the trick was to get the volume up there. As I said, we started when there was no market for this product, and now there is. And so at this point, we're doing fine, no complaints. But the fact is that we're still more or less being held hostage by 1,000 goats.
You have 1,000 goats?
That's what it takes to produce that. They don't give very much milk. That we're not trying to take over the world. It's just that a cow gives you about 100 pounds of milk a day, and the goat give you about seven pounds, and it takes two milkings to get that. So you can see that when we come down to the city now, we come down to the city for a little peace and quiet.
Well, a lot of people have this dream, you know, of starting a farm. So what do you say to them?
We do get many calls. People are just so, you know, delighted with what they think we did, that we moved into this wonderful, glamorous situation. And I generally, when they call and say that they would like to do the same thing, I suggest they take a cold shower and call me in the morning.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I'm glad you invited me.
Miles Kahn and his wife Lillian make goat cheese on the Koch Dairy Goat Farm in the Hudson Valley. His book is The Perils and Pleasures of Domesticating Goat Cheese. So if you can instant message across the world and actually have that message translated into other languages, doesn't it make sense that what you eat and where you eat it might change in similar ways? Well, reporter Anne-Marie Ruff covers the global food scene for us. She joins us from a mystery location.
Teatro is one of those restaurants that feels like an adventure, a mini vacation, a magic carpet ride to a place you've never been before. My friend Angela was my traveling companion for a recent gastronomical adventure at Teatro. And you'll never guess where Teatro is.
It's like the best from all over the world. Confuses me. I don't know what I want.
It's totally overwhelming, isn't it? Should I have pasta or California-style food or sushi or Indian or Chinese or Thai or...
You can also have European.
Of course, Angela notices the European food since she comes from Denmark. And I notice the California cuisine because I spent a decade in Los Angeles. But this restaurant seems to exist somewhere beyond all homelands. The waitress, who hails from the Philippines, offers no clues about where this restaurant might be, but she does offer some suggestions for what we might order.
Pastas. What do you recommend in pasta?
Pasta, you want the California love, I can recommend to you.
Okay.
Because that's also my favorite, that's why I'm recommending it.
After a tour of the menu, we decide on a globe-trotting dinner.
Miss Angela, I just want to repeat your order. You're going to start with prawn popia chinois, and for main course, one California love, prawn malay curry, spicy tuna maki, and cabrera roll for sharing for your main course.
While we're waiting for the food, the restaurant manager, Sheetal Patel, comes to chat with us. She's from Gujarat State in India, but she says her guests come from all over.
Very mixed, Europeans, Arabs, a minority of guests from the subcontinent, but majority are Europeans and Arabs.
The first appetizer arrives, a crispy wonton filled with shrimp mousse and topped with chipotle chili mayonnaise. The chipotle chili sauce hints at the chef de cuisine's heritage. Gavina Montoya is Mexican-American and comes from San Francisco, but he says it's been about 10 years since he lived there.
I just recently came from Simon in China. Before that, I was in Hong Kong, Malaysia, India, and Singapore.
But this restaurant is in none of those places. And the amazing mango and avocado sushi roll that comes next is not a place marker, but a brilliant invention of the Filipino sushi chef. And the Italian Valpacello wine we are enjoying has come out of an ultra-modern wine cellar designed by New York-based designer Tony Chi. After indulging in an Indian prawn curry with a decadent coconut and cashew sauce, I headed to the kitchen to see the preparation of the dessert platter we had ordered. Teatro actually has two kitchens, an eastern kitchen and a western kitchen, and that is a clue to Teatro's location. It is in the Arab world, a place where east meets west. Gavina's 16 multinational staff use some high technology to synchronize everything.
What we do is we talk on headphones and microphones to coordinate what's coming up at what times. That means if you order something from the sushi station, the tandoor station, the wok station, and the western kitchen, we're talking to each other, the people who are picking up the food, to make sure that everything gets to the table at the same time.
And that explains the location. a place in the Arab world where East meets West and where high technology reigns. That place is Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, a tiny country bordered by the Persian Gulf and Saudi Arabia, a place where 80% of the population hails from somewhere else, where cultures mix, and where people obviously like to eat.
Oh my goodness. Ah, it's so good.
Okay, I just want to stay here and eat for the rest of my life.
Well, so do I. Can I join you, please?
Freelance reporter Anne-Marie Ruff is based in Abu Dhabi. Restaurant Teatro is in Dubai. What you read in your local paper's food section shapes a lot of tastes and influences a lot of local businesses. So who determines what gets into print? Well, the buck stops with the food editor, and putting together that weekly food page can be tricky business. Cheryl Julian knows all about this. She creates one of America's top newspaper food sections every single week. She's food editor of the Boston Globe and co-author of a new book, The Way We Cook, Recipes from the New American Kitchen. Cheryl, good to have you with us.
Hello, Lynn.
You know, my prime question for you and for any food editor is, what makes a food section fly?
Well, I call it a bear. It's just a bear to put together because the demographics of the readership are very, very large. When I was hired, the editor said to me, don't forget that all of your friends are reading the food section, but so are their mothers. And that was sort of an eye-opener because I forgot about their mothers. And I thought it was just my mother. So we have to have something for their mothers and, of course, for our children and their friends. You have to be considerate of the readers, and you have to remember that they're coming home late. They have a bit of a commute. There are boots in the front hallway and kids tugging at them for dinner. And there's a lot to do, and they can't start roasting red peppers. And I mean, although red peppers are lovely, but they can't do that at night.
You've co-authored this book with Julie Riven called The Way We Cook. Does this directly reflect your food page?
It reflects the Boston Globe magazine, which is where a long-running column runs. We got a reputation on dishes that I would never dream of making today, and they were very sophisticated, you know, racks of lamb and kulibiak of salmon and some very fancy dishes that I thought, the way everybody thought, that we should be at home cooking like restaurateurs. But that, of course, is not the way people really eat. Food is gotten much simpler, and we're always of the mind that you can take out an ingredient and you'll be fine.
So if you don't have it, just drop it and
absolutely
do something
or substitute
else.
It or have a ball, go to your pantry, don't go back to the grocery store, whatever you do.
Okay, I like this instruction. Where do the ideas come from? Where do you get the recipes? What inspires you guys?
Well, we cook a lot together. And as you know, a lot happens in the kitchen when you're cooking with people. You just feel good. It's a nice warm place. It's why everyone gravitates to the kitchen. And the ideas just flow. And then other recipes come from people who we've met who we think are wonderful home cooks, and we want to share their stories, and they're fun.
Any favorites there?
Our favorite in the last few years is a woman named Arlene DeMello. She's born to a Portuguese family in New Bedford. And New Bedford, as you know, is a big whaling center in New England, and the Portuguese came there to work on the ships. And she told us maybe we shouldn't bother coming because she just makes chicken with rice. And she told us the story of her chicken and rice, which, by the way, is quite fabulous and has peppers in it, and she marinates the chicken overnight and makes it in the morning before she goes to work in her husband's landscaping company. And when she and he wanted to get married, both families were quite poor. They couldn't get married until her mother had raised enough chickens to have the wedding feast of chicken with rice.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
Yes.
Cheryl Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Cheryl Julian is food editor of the Boston Globe. She is co-author of The Way We Cook. Now, you can get that recipe for Portuguese chicken with rice on the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Crystal on the line. Hey, Crystal, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. My husband and I have a debate that I hope that you can help us with.
Okay, I'll try.
My husband loves to eat bay leaves, and I cannot find a definitive answer. Everybody says, oh, no, nobody wants to eat bay leaves, but... is that just because that's tradition, or is it because they're not good for you?
Wait a minute. You're saying he actually sits there, and when he has nothing to do, he nibbles on bay leaves?
No, well, no. I cook with them.
And, right.
You know, in the Indian food that I make, you know, you have the fresh curry leaves. You cook that, and you can eat those.
Mm-hmm, that's right. That's
and
right.
So his thinking is, why can't he eat the bay leaf? And I'm like, well, it's crunchy and yucky, and nobody in their right mind would like to eat that. And he says, well, I do. And I'm like, well, that just proves you're not in your right mind.
I really don't think I should get in the middle of this. I'm a little bit nervous about this.
Well, he just wants to know, and he's actually the one that suggested I call you and find out if it was actually medically unsound or if it was just a tradition.
Well, I'm thinking here, what's the logic here? No, this is what I'm thinking. You can buy ground bay leaf as a spice. I don't advise it because it's musty, and I think it's better to use the whole leaf.
Oh, see, I've never even seen the ground.
Yeah, occasionally you'll find it in spice catalogs. And if that's true, then the bay leaf isn't harmful.
Okay.
You know, I don't think it'll do him any harm to eat it. Mm-hmm. I find it...
unappetizing?
Well, no. You've put me in the middle. Now I'm going to... Now I'm really going to get into trouble.
Well, not with him.
Well, I just think it's hard to chew, and I worry a little bit about his digestion because it's kind of tough, but, it tastes just fine.
Right. I mean, that's the whole purpose of cooking with it is the flavoring.
Why don't you just resign yourself to the fact that you have married a man who has very distinctive tastes?
Well, I knew
and
he had
you're proof of that, so it's got to be good. Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it's going to do him any harm at all.
Okay. Well, wonderful. That's all I wanted to be sure of. I just didn't want to think I was poisoning my husband trying to do something kind for him.
Nah. Now, if he asks for oleander leaves, then he's in deep trouble. Don't let him get near him.
Okay.
You take care, and thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, guys, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What's the connection between South Beach, cavemen, and sex? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what's the connection between South Beach, cavemen, and sex? Well, the answer is fad diets. South Beach diet is that physician-friendly program. And then, of course, there is the caveman diet. Now, the idea is that there were no overweight cavemen. So if you eat mastodon with lots of fruits and vegetables, you'll look just like a cave person. Anyway, the sex diet is another take. Binges are replaced by, well, other activities. Then there is making money by losing weight. Drug companies pay human guinea pigs for testing new weight loss medicines. And to sweeten the pot, evidently, the government even offers tax breaks for trying new weight loss programs. Of course, low carb is the big thing right now. I love this craziness. Last night, a waiter asked me if I wanted to try their new low carb cocktail. Okay, let's get back to those phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, we've got Joan calling. So, Joan, what's on your mind? What do you
Hi.
Want to discuss?
How are you, Lynn?
I am fine.
Well, good. I received a wonderful piece of lamb that is a top round. I've never cooked this before. This friend of mine told me that it's the Cadillac of the cuts of lamb, and it's about 2.5 pounds. It is slightly marbled, but it really does look like a piece of beef, and I don't want to cook it the way my mother used to cook beef forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to serve this with some type of a really nice berry sauce. Do you have any ideas?
Oh, boy. Well, the top round, if you think about this, is it boneless, by the way?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, usually it is. The top round is, if you'll pardon the expression, it's the tuchus
mm-hmm.
of the lamb. It's
mm-hmm.
its tush.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cut that really comes from right above where the leg comes from.
Right.
And it's just solid, delicious flesh. And, and the best, do you like your lamb pink?
Yes, I do.
Okay, this is good because this is the kind of thing that's really best slow roasted until it's about, 128, 130 degrees
uh-huh.
internal temperature.
Uh-huh.
And then you let it rest maybe 10 minutes. You tent it with foil and it'll come out medium rare.
Mm-hmm.
And then you thin slice it and it will be out of this world. Now, one of the things, it's by the way, when I say slow roast, 325?
325, okay.
Yeah, I'd uh-huh. rather slow roast than fast roast on this one.
Okay.
I would trim most of the fat off. There probably isn't a lot on it.
Mm-hmm. No, there's not much at all.
Okay. And then what you want to do, though, you can, you know, you can make slits in it with a paring knife,
mm-hmm.
and you can stick all kinds of seasonings in, whatever you think you would like.
Oh, like some rosemary and garlic.
That's right. And you know what? If you're doing rosemary and garlic, what might be nice to do is some dried sour cherry.
Oh, I love that.
You know,
berries on lamb.
Yeah. See, what I'm thinking is if you do some sour dried cherries that you soak, okay,
mm-hmm.
and you can soak them in white wine.
Oh, yeah.
This would not be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you chop them coarsely and you put some inside the lamb with the garlic and the rosemary.
Oh.
This would be so good. And then what I would do is I would take a lot of that mixture and I'd rub it on the outside of the lamb, too, along with salt and pepper.
Rub it on the outside. Okay.
Slow roast it
uh-huh.
and baste it with some white wine or red wine. Take your choice.
Okay.
But I would sprinkle a handful of those or half a handful of those dried cherries along with some chopped garlic in the pan.
In the pan. Okay.
In fact, let's go a step further and make a great pan sauce for you.
Okay.
Here's the deal. You're going to put that lamb on a rack mm-hmm. in the roasting pan. The roasting pan's going to be low, but the rack is going to be some stalks of celery, some sliced onion, like one stalk of celery you cut up
uh-huh.
in big chunks, some sliced onion in 1-inch chunks, and some carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And you set the lamb on that, so that'll flavor all the juices.
Oh, wonderful.
Slow roast the lamb, baste it with the red wine, baste it with its own pan juices, have that, some lots of garlic in there and the cherries in there. And then when you take the lamb out and you let it rest,
mm-hmm.
you can strain off that liquid.
Mm-hmm.
You can throw more wine into the pan to scrape up any brown
scrape
bits,
sure.
right? Take some of the fat off the liquid, put the liquid back in there and simmer.
Oh.
simmer it until it's lush and rich in flavor. You don't need any flour, you don't need any thickening, and you'll get that tart berry flavor.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Oh,
big
boy.
Platter of asparagus and some roasted potatoes.
You're there.
It sounds wonderful.
You are absolutely home free.
Thank you so much.
Now we're going to all wish that somebody sends us a round of lamb. Hey, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks
Goodbye.
So much. Uh-huh.
The idea of having the lamb with the dried cherries, and that's a great, you know, you can use dried apricots, you could use dried peaches, you could use wedges of, orange or lemon, but I'm talking not about the rind, just the fruit. It'd be absolutely scrumptious. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Dane on the phone calling from Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Dane, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, the big question is, and it's an argument I get into with my family every year come holiday time,
yeah,
is liquid measurements or dry measurements, solid versus wet. And I maintain it doesn't really make a difference. I'm an engineer by profession, and I figure there's always tolerances. And I always thought of cooking was more of an art as opposed to a science. And I also subscribe to a theory, if it looks like the picture, it must be done.
But
my family, my family maintains the fact that they have ruined dishes by using a liquid cup measure as opposed to a solid measure. And so the other day I even started weighing water versus sugar
right.
in liquids and solids. I come up with like 17 grams of difference. I figure when you watch almost any cooking show on TV, they'll always say, you know, oh, well, you want to use one level this and then throw in a little extra. There's tolerance in there. Does it really make a difference?
You know, this is interesting because, you are an engineer and you're used to very exacting measurements. My first reaction is, okay, off the top of my head, it really makes a difference in baking. It does not necessarily make a huge difference in other cooking. In baking, you're looking at a reaction a reaction takes place whenever you cook. But here you're looking at a particular chemical reaction that has to take place. Generally, the rule in baking is a liquid measure for liquid, a solid measure, what you would call a cup or whatever, for all dry foods, because it's much easier to level and you can know you have an exact amount. That said, professional bakers whose living depends on the consistency and the quality of what they do never measure either way. They measure by weight. Because I can show you with, let's say, that dry measure to make a cup of flour, I can show you how you can get anything from 3.5 ounces of flour in that cup to 6 ounces, all depending on how you handle it. If you tap it and level it, if you just spoon it in so it's very fluffy and then level it, it'll be very little. It'll be a lighter weight. If you scoop it into the bag of flour and level it, if you spoon it in 3.5 ounces more or less per cup, 3 to 4 ounces, if you dip it into a sack of flour and level it, 5 ounces. If you dip it into the sack of flour and before you level it, you tap it, 6 ounces. And this does lead to hockey puck problems. I mean, this can lead to a cake that, you could sink a battleship with. But that's baking. And, but when it comes to the cup of carrots that's called for in the stew.
Well, carrots have an odd shape to them.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. And by the way, there we go back again. Pros always use weight. They
okay.
always use weight. So I would say that if you're baking, I back your family. But being an engineer, I would tell you, you weigh.
Well, being an engineer, I should stay out of the kitchen altogether.
No. My husband's an engineer. He's a dynamite cook. You may not want to have other people in the kitchen with you, but that's a whole other issue.
Exactly.
Hey, Dane, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. This really is, though, it's almost, a fanatic subject, but a great investment to kick off another year. think about investing in a good kitchen scale. There's a lot of evaluations out there. You can go online and find them. You want a scale that you can just zero back the scale. You know, you'll have 7 ounces of sugar, and then you want to put in, let's say, a pound of butter. You zero it back. You put in the butter until it reads 1 pound. So think about investing in a kitchen scale. They're also just fun to use. Okay, 800-537-5252. We have Tim calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Tim, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I have a question about when I grew up, which was, of all places, in the middle of Wyoming. I didn't eat a lot of seafood, but my parents liked it. And my mother, she had grown up eating abalone and loved it. And I made the mistake later in life of eating abalone and fell in love with it. It's just the most divine thing I've ever eaten.
You are never going to be a cheap date. You know this. It's so expensive. But go on, please.
Well, the last time I had it, incidentally, it was in San Diego, and it was a la carte, $76. And it wasn't good.
It may have been frozen. Or, you know, just not fresh or whatever. Yeah. Oh, gosh. $76. I mean, you could get an aqualung and go down and get your own for that amount of money.
I have done a little bit of research, and I'm curious as to what you might be able to add to my knowledge of purveyors of abalone. I understand that there are commercial operations now springing up.
Now, that, I have to tell you, I draw a blank on. The only thing I could suggest is hitting the internet, and there's one source I might go to. The Monterey Bay Aquarium is obviously Monterey, California, and they gather information, ecological information from all over the world about seafood, you know, endangered, plentiful enough to eat, etc. But I would wonder if people there, because they're gathering information from all over the world, might not be able to share some sources for you. Now, I have read, I've never tried it, that there is frozen abalone, even beaten, because for those of you who aren't familiar with the abalone, it almost looks like a huge clam. And what you eat after you trim away all the dark stuff and the brown stuff is this big, white, beautiful mussel that is really a foot. And you sometimes, if the abalone is not absolutely super, super, super fresh, you pound it, you know, the way you would pound veal scallopini, and you cook abalone either fast, like a minute, or you cook it real slow to make it tender. It's kind of cook it like squid, you know, either in a flash or very slow, and it can be luscious.
The other thing I'm probably more intent on is how to prepare it.
I think this is the classic way of doing it. Remember what I said about you have to cook it. It's like squid. If you want it tender, you cook it very fast or very slow.
Right.
So if you're cooking it very fast, you've pounded it out, right? You can even cut it into pieces, you know, smaller pieces if you want. You dip it in egg, and then you roll it in breadcrumbs. And if you want super crisp, you can roll it in the panko, P-A-N-K-O, crumbs from Japan. They're kind of flaky. I've known people to roll it in lightly crushed corn flakes, and it's worked. And then what you do is you pan fry it. So you want about a half an inch of oil in the pan, all right? You salt and pepper it very lightly, and you get that oil so that it almost, it's like shimmering on the top, but just a half an inch of it. In goes the abalone. Quick, like 30 seconds, it starts to brown. Fine, flip it, another 30 seconds, and out. Drain it on paper towels and eat it right away. And it's that simple. And you can vary what crumbs or whatever you use to get different effects, but keep it that simple. Okay? That should work.
Thank you.
You are welcome. And when you find one, enjoy. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye, Tim. Abalone, $76 a plate. Okay, you're simplifying your life, and you're into recycling. So you do the paper stuff, not plastic. But what about those plastic forks? I mean, I figure they probably live forever in the landfill. Well, Andrea Wilson has a solution. She's a former environmental activist who started a company called Green Earth Office Supply. Hey, Andrea, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So, Andrea, what are you doing?
Well, we have a business. It's online, and we also have a store, and we sell environmentally friendly office, school, and food service supplies. Everything from recycled to biodegradable to less toxic to products that promote reuse and products that are energy efficient.
So, for instance, the plastic fork, knife, you know, problem, what does your stuff do?
Well, it basically, it doesn't live forever. It biodegrades, and it's made from renewable resources. These products are made from agricultural products. A lot of the products are made from corn. We have plates that are made from potato starch. They're made from wheat. We have a cutlery that's made from wheat. We have a lot of interesting products.
Can I eat the cutlery?
I guess if you're on a desert island and you're starving, maybe you can.
So this is all kind of new technology in a lot of ways.
It's absolutely. And most of the products, you know, there's very different types of products there. So there's different technologies, you know, involved. And, you know, one of the more interesting one is the one that's called polylactic acid. And that's basically glucose from crops. And believe it or not, that actually is made by Cargill Dow, makes the raw material on that. And basically anything that's made out of plastic can be made out of that material. So, you know, over a period of time, we're going to be seeing, you know, a lot more product availability. So it's very exciting.
It really is.
You know, and a lot of people want to do it. We get calls from unbelievable sources, you know, that are mainstream that want to do it, but a lot of times price does get them. Mm-hmm. But the people that are actually, you know, really, really doing, for instance, would be, you know, ones like vegetarian restaurants and ones like that. And, you know, part of it is if you're, you know, a vegetarian organic restaurant and you have a certain guilt factor if, you know, if you're just putting all your wonderful food in
Styrofoam. Yeah, exactly.
And so these people are just like, whoa, they're just so excited. So they're on board, you know, that's where the strongest base of support of people actually, you know, committing with their dollars and buying the products are.
Well, this is great. Hey, Andrea, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Andrea Wilson is proprietor of Green Earth Office Supply based in Los Gatos, California. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this from writer-director Nora Ephron. She said, "What my mother believed about cooking was that if you worked hard and prospered, someone else would do it for you." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Nearly everything you will ever need in life can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.